Thank you, Andy. Like probably most of you here, I've been thinking a lot since March about the effects that Bob has had on me as a scientist and on my career and how I go about doing my research. And a lot of those effects that he has on people are grounded in Bob's incredible passion for natural history. This is a photo that Merrill Peterson took on a butterfly collecting trip. And of course, Bob was incredibly passionate about butterflies. He should have been, instead of Vad the Impaler, he was like Bob the Defaunator. And so every trip, I remember once he came back from a trip to Greece. We went to a meeting or something, and he had taken his butterfly net and stuff, and he was complaining about the collecting wasn't very good, and all the habitats were trashed. And I said, well, how many specimens do you collect? Oh, like 1,000. It was just like that was a bad collecting trip for him. So this passion, he had this incredible passion for butterflies that dates back to when he was a very young child. And this also was tied to his incredible field botany. I mean, he was just an incredible field botanist. A trip into the field with him was just an incredible learning experience. It was Natural History 101. And anyone who's really spent any time doing work with Bob came, at the end of your time, your stay as a postdoc or a student or whatever, you were a better natural historian by far than you were when you entered his lab. And you were more passionate about natural history than you were before you entered his lab. And you would think that someone who worked, were so passionate about natural history, was such an amazing field biologist and natural historian, would have chosen to study, complex species-rich habitats that were full of the jazzy insects that he loved. But of course, he didn't do that with his career. He chose to study what, and we all know Bob had this very colorful language to describe things. And he would have described this as, drizzly plants and drizzly bugs that he studied. And so he spent, of course, his most of his career studying these drizzly plants and these drizzly bugs in a very simple system. There is very low plant diversity out there. And there's relatively low arthropod diversity out there. No offense to all of you marsh geeks, but and what Bob showed us is that even arthropod communities in simple systems are often complex. Although it's relatively low diversity, maybe compared to a tropical rainforest, these systems are still relatively species rich. More than enough players in those systems to keep you busy for your entire career. And they're trophically diverse. They're packed with omnivores and intraguild predators and all of these things that have complex trophic interactions. And these systems are loaded with many indirect effects, which makes them very interesting once you start studying them, but also can make them frustratingly difficult to understand. And so I did my PhD with Bob, and when I went out on my own and got my own faculty position and started my own research program, being trained by Bob, and his way of approaching insect ecology, of course I went and chose my own drizzly systems to start trying to figure out some of these trophic interactions. And so we have worked in some agricultural systems, cotton, soybean, tomato, and collards. And we'll talk today mainly about what we've tried, what we've learned in cotton, but reference some of the other systems. But one thing I did differently than Bob is that I moved to the southeastern United States, and it was clear once you went out into these disturbed habitats that one of the most abundant arthropods in the systems was red imported fire ants. And so red imported fire ants is this highly abundant, aggressive, nasty, invasive species. So this is not a drizzly bug. And so although Bob had some concerns about that, when my first entomology meeting after I'd started as an assistant professor, and he asked me, well, what are you going to do with your research down there? And I told Bob that I was going to study fire ants. He was kind of concerned because Bob had this sort of hierarchy of things that insect ecologists that he trained and was associated with should study. And I think when I said red imported fire ants, he thought I was going to go off and become a sociobiologist or something, which was very, not right in Bob's world of what, his students should be doing. So but this is not a drizzly bug for several reasons, but one of which is it has a lot of charisma, and people love to hate fire ants. You know, they're very passionate about fire ants. So it's not a drizzly little bug. And so we thought that, starting our research, that fire ants were likely to be a keystone species in agricultural systems in the areas that they've invaded, that they would have strong negative effects on the abundance of other predators, strong negative effects on the abundance of the arthropods in those systems. And we went out and we did several years of research where we did laboratory greenhouse field experiments, a classic sort of, you know, deno type approach to insect ecology, and we did find very strong effects on herbivores in these systems and on the natural enemies that live in these systems. But one thing we found that I wasn't really expecting was we found lots of variation in the effects of fire ants on both the herbivores and the natural enemies in these systems. We found temporal variation such that if I did an experiment in a cotton field and found a large effect on fire ants, I could come back in 3 weeks or 6 weeks and repeat that experiment, and I might find a very small effect of fire ants on the arthropods in that system, even though the abundance of fire ants didn't change. We found spatial variation, such that I could do experiments in a cotton field right here and then go down the road a mile and run the same experiments in another field, and I might get very different effects of fire ants on the arthropods in the system, even though the abundances of fire ants in the two fields were very similar. And also we found some variation among crops, and some of that variation was consistent. When we did our experiments, we typically found much stronger effects of fire ants in cotton than, say, in soybean or collards. So we spent a while trying to figure out what was underlying this variation, what could explain this variation in the effects of fire ants, because it wasn't the abundance of fire ants. And we hypothesized after working in these systems for a little while that that the effects of fire ants on other arthropods was correlated with the abundance of honeydew-producing insects like cotton aphids and cotton. And we predicted, based on some field observations, that as the density of honeydew-producing insects increased, we would get more fire ants up on plants, and they would be more aggressive towards especially natural enemies because they form these facultative mutualisms with honeydew-producing insects. But we also hypothesized that they were removing the herbivores in the systems too. And so my first master student to work on this project was Ian Kaplan, who then he wanted to be inbred. He went to Deno's lab and did his PhD. But Ian tested this hypothesis and he found strong support for this hypothesis. For example, this is some field data that Ian collected. This is the number of aphids per sample on the x-axis, the number of lady beetle larvae per sample on the y-axis. We have fields that have low densities of fire ants, so we experimentally suppress those fire ants. And we had cotton fields that had high or naturally occurring populations of fire ants or densities of fire ants. And as you can see in the fields with low fire ants or almost no fire ants, we got pretty good at suppressing the fire ants. We would actually see positive relationships between aphids and ladybird beetle larvae, which is not surprising because lady beetles have strong numerical responses to aphids in the field. But in the fields where we still had high fire ant densities, we would see strong negative relationships between aphid density and lady beetle larvae. And Ian showed in a series of experiments that this is because as aphid density increases on the plants, you get a concomitant increase in the number of fire ants that are on that plant and a concomitant increase in the predation of the herbivores and natural enemies that live on that plant. So if you look at the herbivore data, it looks very similar to this. So we then started thinking that instead of a keystone species, maybe we thought fire ants were going to be a keystone species, that maybe what we were finding was a keystone interaction that was embedded in this food web such that when aphids were present on plants, they dramatically increased the effect of fire ants on both the natural enemies in the food web and the herbivores in the food web. We then wanted to ask, well, what's the consequence of this for the plants? Would this effect of fire ants on both the natural enemies and the herbivores cascade down the food web to affect the plants? My PhD student, John Stiersky, tested this hypothesis in a series of field experiments. John found that plants, and so we actually hypothesized that this could benefit the plants under certain conditions. Because aphids are pests, but at low to moderate densities, they really don't cause a lot of direct feeding damage. They don't have dramatic effects on yield or fitness of the plants. When you compare that to serious defoliators, or especially things that feed on the fruits of plants, those things are going to have far greater effects on yield, especially in the case of cotton, where you're harvesting the product that's produced in the fruit. We hypothesize that this mutualism could decrease damage to the plant by these more damaging or more economically important pests, and therefore benefit the plants. And that's exactly what John found. He found that, instead of showing a bunch of data slides, I'm just going to show you some photos. This is the average, what an average cage where we put caterpillars on the plants that did not have aphids on the plants, but fire ants were allowed to forage in those cages. And this is the average cage where you had the ant-aphid mutualism present. So we had fire ants foraging in the cages. We put caterpillars on the plant, but those plants had aphids. So on the plants with aphids, you had more fire ants foraging on the plants, and they killed the caterpillars before the caterpillars could cause damage. So you had significantly less damage with the aphids than without. And you had significantly less damage also to the bowls, to the fruit of the cotton, and that resulted in a significantly increase in the lint and seed production. So yield increase. So we thought, aha, I felt really happy. I was patting myself on the back. We had found that we have this keystone interaction embedded in this food web, such that when aphids are present on the plants, the fire ants, it enhances their effects on the predators, but also on the herbivores. These effects, cascade down the food web, increase plant fitness. And I really thought, I'd hoped, that this term keystone interaction would really take off. That'd be a really cool thing. Because I'd always wanted to coin some phrase. You know, as an ecologist, we're always making up jargon. And those of us who work with Bob, I mean, he was just an incredible jargon guy when it came to ecology. You know, his papers are just littered with ecological jargon. So I was thinking, keystone interaction, that'd be great. And John went out into the literature. We thought that this might be important in other systems, and John Stiersky reviewed the literature and found that he found about 35 or so studies that had collected this kind of data in other systems, and he found that in 76% of those studies, that the hosting the mutualism, whether it was like a scale ant or a scale aphid mutualism, increase plant fitness or plant production. So we think that this is actually a widespread phenomenon in nature, and John's paper supported that. But when I recently moved to Texas, I started thinking more about this system and the things that we had observed, and I began to wonder that maybe we had it wrong, though, that we had this keystone interaction, or we thought we had found this keystone interaction that involved this jazzy insect, the red imported fire ant, that was going to explain a lot of the trophic variation and what's going on in the system, but that maybe we should really step back and think more about what the effects of aphids are, because they're part of that keystone mutualism if it really occurs. But aphids have other effects. You know, they not only attract ants to plants, you know, they attract lots of natural enemies to plants like lady beetles and lace wings, and these are mainly aphid predators, but they also eat other things, you know. Lady beetles can eat caterpillars and stuff like that. They also, aphids have direct effects on plants that could alter the host plant for other herbivores. So perhaps we should investigate a little more about what the effects of aphids are on the food web of cotton and on cotton plants and their indirect effects on other herbivores such as caterpillars. And so Steve Frank, Carolyn Zender, and Brittany DeLoach started asking these questions recently in Texas A&M, and they found some really interesting results. For example, it turns out that aphids do induce plant defenses in cotton plants. This is some data on the number. One thing they do is they induce the production or at least increase the density of pigment glands. So these are gossypol-containing pigment glands that have really nasty effects on caterpillars. These are cotton plants with no aphids versus plants with aphids. You can clearly see an increase in their density. These glands really interfere with caterpillar feeding. When they hit these glands, the caterpillars rear up and start trying to clean off their mouth parts, and they spend far, Steve has documented that the caterpillars spend far less time eating the plants and consume less leaf tissue. We also found that aphids induce trypsin inhibitor, peroxidases, chitinases, and we think many other things that we haven't gotten around to measuring yet. And so we see, and when we run experiments where we rear caterpillars on leaves from cotton plants that had no aphids on them versus leaves of cotton plants that did have aphids, we see a reduction in caterpillar growth, reduction in caterpillar survival, smaller pupae, all those good things. But of course, they also attract these natural enemies. We find that the amount of time that lacewing larvae and lady beetles spend foraging on plants with aphids versus without aphids is significantly increased by aphids. We see that the proportion, or that caterpillar survival is lower on, or excuse me, so these are all plants with lady beetles, and we see on plants with aphids, we see lower survival of these caterpillars in the presence of lady beetles. So this is an increase in lady beetle predation on plants with aphids versus without. So caterpillars are paying a double whammy. They're getting hit by plant defenses, but they're also getting hit by the natural enemies that aphids are attracting to these plants. And so, and Steve had presented some results this morning of some really cool field experiments that they ran this summer, and they really have begun to nail this down, that aphids are having, you know, these dramatic effects on the host plants, and that affects the caterpillars and other herbivores in the systems, and the aphids are having dramatic effects on the natural enemy community that then has really negative effects on the caterpillars. And so I started out thinking that we had this keystone species in the system, this red imported fire ant, this jazzy bug in the system that was dramatically altering natural enemy and the natural enemy and herbivore community, and then those effects were cascading down to the plant. Then we thought, well, maybe we had this keystone interaction between aphids and fire ants that was explaining a lot of the trophic variation in the system. But then now here recently, we really are back to the keystone species idea but maybe our aphid is a keystone species that's having a really large disproportionate effect on this food web because of these effects on the arthropod, on the arthropod predator community, and its effects on other herbivores via these plant-mediated effects. So I have to come to the conclusion, based on our work to date, that I think Bob would really agree with, and I think he would appreciate it too, and strongly agree with it. And so I think I would almost like to propose that it would be like the Dino principle or something like that. And that is that drizzly shit bugs rule simple systems. So, thanks for your time. So apparently I have time for questions. So there are definitely parasitoids that go after these caterpillars. And to be honest, I'm not real familiar with what the we haven't really measured parasitization rates in the field. So I don't have a good feel. You know, my impression is that they're not very high, that the parasitism rates are not very high. But that's just based on gestalt versus real data. Yeah, that would be really cool. That's very interesting. Certainly a possibility, because when we get to high aphid densities, like during some of Steve's experiments, I mean, you know, the honeydew production is incredible. So there are a lot of carbohydrate resources there. Yeah, I think aphids are the easiest for us to study, because we know that we get these strong numerical responses of these other natural enemies. And I would like to get to that kind of question in the future. We're now looking at other herbivores besides caterpillars, so things like stink bugs and things like that, to look at what these induced effects, plant effects have, and what the natural enemies have. And so we are finding that part of the natural enemy effect is not consumptive, that when there are plants loaded with these natural enemies, the some caterpillars die due to predation, but a lot of caterpillars just walk off the plants. And so I think that a lot of herbivores don't like spending a lot of time on plants that are loaded with natural enemies. And so I don't think that lady beetles eat stink bugs, but I think that stink bugs might not like to be on plants with lady beetles, those sorts of things. But we would like to look at other pairwise comparisons. Do I have one more?
Go ahead, quickly.
I don't really have a comment, so I don't have any questions. I don't know if there's time, but I was at the Greek meeting in 1993 that you referred to.
Ah, yeah.
The International Ocneraca Congress, and there were about 100 of us, leafhopper, plant hopper experts, and all gave a fantastic talk on Proboscidea and ecology. About halfway through the meeting, they piled everybody into buses and drove us way up in the mountains above Delphi, Greece, where the meeting was held in a beautiful conference center, and they dumped us in the middle of a very sparse, bare, practically non-vegetated meadow with no food, no water, and said, go with it! And left us there for 4 hours. And we all stand around like trying to figure out what to do. Well, there were a group of about a dozen of the systemists who immediately just started going out and tromping all over the vegetation with their small mini DVAC Ocneraca collecting device, vacuuming all the foliage furiously. And here was Bob with his fold-out butterfly nest, running everywhere, chasing butterflies. And there was a group of people like, what are you doing here?
That's a cool story. Thanks.